This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. No other Englishman beheaded by a monarch has moved as much product as Sir Walter Raleigh. The image of the Elizabethan explorer has been used to sell cigarettes, pipe tobacco, Hollywood blockbusters, and in the North Carolina city that bears his name, even cars.
Let's go Chevy shopping, deals are popping. Sir Walter Chevrolet, you get higher trade-ins, lower prices. Sir Walter Chevrolet.
Are you tired of riding?
So what has extended the appeal of the 16th century courtier and poet into the 21st century? It could be his various accomplishments. Legend holds that he won Queen Elizabeth's favor when he threw his velvet cloak over a puddle to keep her feet from getting wet, and that he planted the English flag on the North Carolina coast, and that he introduced potatoes and tobacco to Europe. Trouble is, none of that seems to be true. Historian Mark Nichols believes Sir Walter Raleigh is worthy of a mighty reputation anyway. He is co-author of Sir Walter Raleigh in Life and Legend. It presents a more complicated picture of the man. Mark Nichols joins me now to talk more about Sir Walter. Mark, welcome to the program. It's good to have you.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And of course, you know the importance of Sir Walter Raleigh to us. The fact is he was born just down the street and he took his name from our capital city. But you say there are things that we don't know about him, things we've misunderstood. Tell us really about Sir Walter Raleigh. Who was he?
Sir Walter was a Devon man. He came from the southwest of England. And he was a younger son of a gentleman. So he didn't come from the top rank of English society. He wasn't born to rule. And as a younger son, he didn't inherit land. He didn't inherit property. He had to make his own way in the world. And that, through his own accomplishments, he did.
And was this a period in English history when that was a little easier to do than it might have been 100 years earlier? Was there more social mobility?
That depended on your family's connections. And this is where Sir Walter was lucky. He had family contacts at the court and in society, and he exploited them.
And he did. He got to know Queen Elizabeth. How did he make this connection?
This comes about because he fought in the Irish Wars. He was a soldier in Ireland. He came back from Ireland and was able to present himself credibly as a man who knew what was going on over there. That got him into Elizabeth's circle. And again, from that point, his own charisma, his own bearing allowed him to do the rest.
No velvet cloak and puddle, though.
Sadly not. This is a story which grows after his death, quite a bit after his death. On the other hand, it's the way Sir Walter would have gone about things, and that's always an attractive part of good legends.
So it's true, he was charming, and he did charm her, we think? We're pretty sure of that?
He certainly charmed her. Elizabeth liked to have proper men about her at court. At the same time, she had jobs for him to do, so it was more than just good looks. He worked hard. He was a man who could toil terribly, as a contemporary said.
Well, one of the most impressive aspects of this, of course, is how he continues to infiltrate pop culture even today. The most recent big screen portrayal of Raleigh was in that 2007 film Elizabeth, the Golden Age. The very dashing Clive Owen portrays Raleigh to Cate Blanchett's Queen Elizabeth. Let's listen to a bit of that film.
I like you, Mr. Raleigh.
And I like you.
You know, of course, that when I like a man, I reward him.
I have heard that.
And what have you to say about it?
Reward my mission, Majesty, not me.
Is the mission not the man?
Then you leave me free to like you in return.
Ooh, he's smooth. But how historically accurate would you say that was?
Well, it sums up the way that Elizabeth did go about things. Having said that, she had work in mind for him. He was going to be her man on the spot in the country he came from, the southwest of England. Remember, England is going to war with Spain at the time. The Spanish fleet is a real threat to those exposed coasts down in the corner of her country. She needs someone she can rely on, who will work hard, who will be diligent, who will obey orders, who will essentially keep the lid on things down there. That's what he does.
So she sees him in terms of domestic politics as an important player. We know him, of course, because of his international goings on. He was, in fact, a pirate. Did he actually return some of the gold of Spain to her? And was he a pirate? And was that important to her? Was his colonial and imperial conquest important to her?
He had a vision of a greater English empire. Elizabeth was very pragmatic, though. She had immediate concerns, and those concerns included the threat of invasion from Spain and the very survival of her own regime. So while she liked those proper men around her to think big, to be ambitious for her and for England, when it came down to it, she had her feet on the ground. She knew what really mattered.
Now, look, we call her the Virgin Queen, but that's something we called her. Were they intimate?
No, almost certainly not. Elizabeth led a very, very public life. All eyes were on her. Had there been anything to this, it would have been all around court within hours. The fact is that courtly love is something non-physical. It's expressed through poems, through access, through being able to talk to the Queen, to have her ear. Because if you can do that, then all sorts of people come to you asking for favours through you, and you get power.
So this is a kind of a drama, a sort of a pageant, and everybody knows their part. And he was indeed a poet, and a pretty well, at least in his time, well recognized.
He was. His poetry is actually very good. It has a melancholy strain running through it, and a pretty skeptical strain running through it. But he has a way with words.
It's interesting to think about this courtly dance that everybody has to know. It's a way to curry favor, to maintain favor, without engaging in the sort of intimacy that could get everybody in trouble. He knew this game. Did he learn it? You said he's the second son. He sort of had to do it on his own. So he was all pretty much self-taught then in the ways of the court.
Yes. He learnt through experience. He had a certain talent for that kind of thing. Unlike Sir Walter as a politician, where he makes all sorts of crucial mistakes, as a courtier, as someone going in that circle around the Queen, he's very adept.
When you look at his poems, what do they tell you about the man himself, Sir Walter Raleigh?
Well, they're full of the neuroses of the courtier, the fear that rivals are stabbing you in the back, are gaining an advantage, the fear that what the Queen gives she may one day take away. But, of course, that adds to the way in which these poems tell us something about Sir Walter himself. They chart stages in his journey with the Queen, his journey into intimacy and then ultimately away from it as well.
And he did engender a great deal of envy, though he had a lot of enemies at court.
He was one of the most hated men at court in his day.
Is that simply because of his success, or also because he was, as you said, politically inept, or seemed to be?
It was both those things, and in addition, his pride and his vanity, and the fact that he loved to tell people that he was successful and they weren't.
That's just not good politics.
It never makes you popular.
In the court. Maybe if he'd hung around a little bit longer, he would have learned more about that. Is there a better understanding? Have you come to a better understanding? And when we read your book, do we know more about his poetry itself?
I think recent scholarship has shown that a lot of the poems that were once attributed to Sir Walter aren't his. So you focus down on a core of really good, really interesting work. And because that body is relatively small, you can study it in a lot of detail and pick out clues to character from the poems which, absolutely beyond dispute, he wrote.
He wrote them, and they're good, and he's considered among the best of his time. And, of course, he shared his time with some of the best poets in all of human language, perhaps. Certainly the English language.
There's the language of Shakespeare that comes out in everyday speech of the period, and he's working in that kind of environment.
It's an environment. It's a time when language itself is exploding. The English language is exploding. And, of course, our concept or their concept of the world was also exploding. So human imagination is becoming expansive as the grammar and the vocabulary of English.
And that's where Sir Walter really succeeds, because he has imagination. He can see beyond the immediate horizon. He sees the potential for empire. He sees the advantage to both queen and to country in colonies, for example.
This is something that's hard for us to understand after the fact, that opening the eyes of those who had never imagined a world beyond England and France, beyond Europe, to the possibilities is a monumental undertaking and in terms of imaginative scope, perhaps one of the grandest enterprises in human. I mean, it's a big thing to try to imagine something that had just never been in anybody's thought before.
It's a huge thing, and not only can Sir Walter write well himself in support of his idea, he's good at gathering together a team, a spin team, if you like, who can put the message across remarkably well.
Who were the members of his team, and did they stay with him?
Well, one thinks of John Dee, Richard Hakluyt, the great chronicler of exploration, Thomas Harriot, the mathematician, and, of course, one of the people who did come to North Carolina in the 1580s. There were a number of very talented men and some women as well who were in that circle.
But not only did he talk about it, he actually took the voyages. He sailed the high seas and went to the colonies. So he was an adventurer as well.
Yes. Against the image of Sir Walter as the dashing sea dog, in fact, he was almost invariably very, very sick when he went to sea and was considered by some to be a bit of a Jonah in that, you know, he was an unlucky sailor, which is actually borne out by the voyages he actually does make. But yes, he was prepared to put his life on the line. He was prepared to set out and do these things.
But there are so many things then as a result that apparently we've gotten wrong. He was a charmer, but so much in pop culture has survived, and apparently wrongly. We're going to listen now to a skit from the 1980s British TV comedy The Blackadder. Here, Rowan Atkinson plays the main character who is expressing his extreme jealousy of Sir Walter Raleigh.
I mean, look at this. What is it?
I'm surprised you've forgotten, my lord.
I haven't forgotten. It's a rhetorical question.
No, it's a potato.
To you it's a potato, to me it's a potato. But to Sir Walter bloody Raleigh, it's country estates, fine carriages, and as many girls as his tongue can cope with. He's making a fortune out of the things. People are smoking them, building houses out of them. We'll be eating them next.
That's from Blackadder. I'm talking with Mark Nichols. He's co-author of Sir Walter Raleigh in Life and Legend. And I guess we get a little bit of both there. We get some of the envy and contempt that he had probably engendered around the court, but also the fact that the potato business and the tobacco business, he did not introduce them to Europe, eh?
He did not. He did help to popularize the smoking of tobacco, and that is about as far as the legends go, I'm afraid.
And he was not the first mayor of Raleigh, North Carolina? This is all coming as hard news to me. What about in his time, though? How well known outside the court was Sir Walter Raleigh?
Oh, in his time, because of his connections with the Queen, he was very well known, heartily despised by many as an upstart, as a self-made man, which didn't go down well in the hierarchical society of Elizabethan England. But he's always news because he is larger than life, because he wears flamboyant clothes. He spends huge sums on his attire, huge sums on jewellery. He looks the part of the royal favourite and gets noticed.
Why, then, would he make the ultimately fatal error, although not in this particular case, but the very dangerous, take the very dangerous step of risking his relationship with the Queen to marry one of her ladies-in-waiting?
You have to remember what Sir Walter is actually doing here. He's the younger son. He's trying to establish his own landed dynasty. Well, to establish a dynasty, you need a wife. And preferably, you need a wife with good connections, good contacts of her own. And he finds such a woman in Elizabeth Throckmorton. Unfortunately, she is a maid of honour, a lady in waiting to the Queen. And the Queen jealously protects those ladies-in-waiting from the advances of people like Sir Walter. So they marry in secret, and that doesn't go down well with Elizabeth at all.
Is it the fact that he paid attention to anyone else, or was it this particular role that she played in court?
It was essentially the link between the Queen and Bess, and he had trampled across that rather sensitive boundary.
But that doesn't get him necessarily beheaded. It takes King James to do that. Tell us about his relationship with James.
James did not trust Sir Walter Raleigh. He didn't trust him because Sir Walter advocated continued war with Spain. James was set on peace. But James's mind had also been poisoned by letters from Sir Walter's rivals at court, who'd been busy writing to him before he becomes King of England, saying, watch out for this man, he's not your friend. So, of course, it's bad news for Sir Walter when James does succeed Elizabeth in 1603.
Live by the pen and die the same way. He's sent to the Tower of London, but then Sir Walter has one last big idea, and he actually convinces James to go along with it.
James is desperate for money. And Sir Walter says, look, I've been to Guyana, to modern-day Venezuela, the Orinoco River. I know that there's gold and silver down there. Let me go and get it. And so James says, OK, go and get it. He tries. It's a total disaster. His eldest son is killed on the expedition, and he himself comes back empty-handed. And, of course, James has no sympathy whatsoever for him at that stage.
He lost a lot of ships along the way, too, didn't he?
Lost a lot of men.
Yeah. So he does, and ultimately he is beheaded.
Yes.
Not before writing a good chunk of the history of the world, no less a topic than the history of the world.
Well, if you're stuck in the Tower of London for 13 years, you've got to do something. And he's, as I say, his busy mind never stops. He's got to have a project in hand. So, yes, he knocks out a million words on the history of the world.
A million words. But he stops a little short. He gets frustrated. How far did he get again?
140 BC.
And then it's like, oh, well, you know the rest.
That's right.
Was it true? The thought was that this would be volume one and perhaps there'd be more, but he lost his head.
No, he'd stopped writing before that. He lost his drive for the history when James's son, Prince Henry, dies. And Sir Walter has been hoping that Prince Henry will be his saviour, his patron. And of course, when you lose your patron, you lose impetus on the project too.
Was that why he came back to England after the disastrous trip to Guyana? You would think that a guy who'd thrown you into the Tower and you had one last chance, if you blow that, don't go back to England.
Well, of course, you've still got a wife and your surviving son in England. And in part, it's looking after them. It's being fair to them to stop James victimizing them. In part, it's because, as he says himself, after the death of his eldest son, my brains are broken. The poor man was desolate. He wasn't thinking straight.
Why do you suppose his legacy and his story lives on the way it does today?
Because he's a larger-than-life character, because he's into everything, and because of that larger-than-life nature to him, people can look at him in so many different ways, can pick up different facets of this magnificent character. He's fascinating.
Fascinating story, fascinating book. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Mark Nichols is librarian and president of St. John's College at the University of Cambridge and co-author with Penry Williams of Sir Walter Raleigh, Life and Legend. Mark Nichols is going to speak this evening, 5 o'clock, Wilson Library, on the campus of UNC. For more information on that event, go to lib.unc.edu. Up next, the Witches of Lublin, just in time for Passover. Stay with us on The State of Things.